in Maseches Shabbos, where the Gemara tells us in Daf Ayin Tes Amud Beis, what happens when you have tefillin that get worn out? So we're talking about tefillin that get worn out, but not just that the batim get worn out, but we're talking about where the parshios, the part that has the Divrei Torah written on them, gets worn out. Or you have a Sefer Torah Shabbala, you have a Sefer Torah that gets worn out, so you cannot use the Sefer Torah any longer because some of the letters are worn out, but you have various selections of the Torah that are still usable. So can I take from that Sefer Torah and, let's say, take out the Parsha of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, that whole Parsha, and use it as a mezuzah? Why commission a sofer to go write you a mezuzah? Why pay extra money? Why not just take the old Sefer Torah that we cannot use anymore because there are letters worn out and use that selection of it for the mezuzah? So the Gemara says you're not allowed to do such a thing. Why is that? Because Ein Moridim Mikdusha Chamura L'Kedusha Kala. The Gemara says one is not allowed to take something that had originally gained the status of a very distinguished Kedusha, like a Sefer Torah, a very superior Kedusha. You cannot downgrade it now to a Kedusha Kala if you have a mezuzah that's obviously not as holy as a Sefer Torah, and therefore you're not allowed to take a portion of the Sefer Torah and use that merely for a mezuzah. This is a principle that we learn not only in Maseches Shabbos, but the real place where we learn it from is the Gemara Menachos Daf Tzadites, and there the Gemara learns the famous principle of Malim Bakodesh Velo Moridin. You only have a right to upgrade and elevate something in Kedusha, you don't have a right to downgrade it. And the Gemara learns this from a pasuk. We have the psukim tell us in Sefer Shemos that Moshe Rabbeinu was instructed every day of the Shivas Yimei HaMiluim. Chanukah, we read all these psukim about when they inaugurated the Beis HaMikdash, when they inaugurated the Mishkan. So the psukim tell us that there was a mitzvah at that time that every day the Mishkan had to be erected and every day it had to be taken down. Every day they had to do the same thing. So the Gemara says, Vayakam Moshe as HaMishkan. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu erects the Mishkan every day. Vayitan as Adonav. He goes and he puts in the nails and he puts the hammer and he's putting everything together and it's a lot of hard work. So the Gemara points out, how come nobody else helped him? Why does it say that Moshe Rabbeinu is the only one doing all the work? He's an old man already. Moshe Rabbeinu is doing all the work every day, putting the Mishkan up by himself. So the Gemara says, because that would be a violation of Malim HaKodesh Velo Moridin. If Moshe Rabbeinu would have had other people helping him out, that would be a downgrade in the Kedusha. Moshe Rabbeinu was infusing the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan, with Kedusha, using his own hands, and therefore we couldn't allow anybody else to help him because that would, so to speak, take away from the Kedusha of the Mishkan. That's what the Gemara learns, a very surprising statement, but that's what the Gemara tells us is the source of this halacha of Malim HaKodesh Velo Moridin. The Rishonim have a discussion, and the Prima Gadim then takes the discussion a little further. Should we assume that this is a real Drasha Gemura? Should we assume this is a real Din de Araisa? Or should we assume that it's just merely an Asmachta Ba'alma? But either way, this is a halacha that we have heard of. It's a famous halacha that Malim HaKodesh Velo Moridin. Along the lines of this very famous halacha, we have the comment of the Yerushalmi, and that is that not only was Moshe Rabbeinu instructed to be the one to erect the Mishkan and construct it every single day, but the Yerushalmi says the following, Keresh Shazacha Lihinasam Batzafon, the beam that had the unbelievable opportunity to be Batzafon. Now, what was so unique, what was special about the northern side of the Beis HaMikdash? What? That was, what? The Shechita, that was one, but also the fact that the northern side was where the menorah. What?
The menorah.
Isn't that where the Kodesh HaKadoshim was? Closer to the northern side? No, correct? So therefore we assume that that side had more of a Kedusha than any other area of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Yerushalmi says that the beam that had the incredible opportunity to be placed on the northern side of the Beis HaMikdash, La'olam Matzafon, that always has to go in the northern side. You cannot put that now next time on the west side, which makes it very difficult. Moshe Rabbeinu has to take down the Mishkan every day, and then he has to put it back up in the exact same order that he put it up yesterday. That's not so easy to do. If it was hard enough for him to put it up just as is, now he has to remember where every beam went. How many of us, when we put up a sukkah, we remember which beam went where and which pole we put where and which side of the panel we used in which area of our house? It's not so simple to figure out where everything goes. But that was the deal that Moshe Rabbeinu had to figure out exactly on which side everything went the first time he put it up. That's where all the beams had to go the next time. The Netziv learns this out from a pasuk because it says, Uvishemos tifkedu es klei mishmeres masa'am. So says the Netziv, Uvishemos tifkedu means you have to write on every beam. This is beam 1, this is beam 2, this is beam 3. Each one has a name, each one has a place. And you cannot split them up and put them in different places where they do not belong. So the Rama in Choshen Mishpat takes this a little bit further. The Rama applies this concept of Keresh Hazacha, when you have a beam that belongs in one place, you cannot put it in another place, because that would be a downgrade in Kedusha. That would put it into a lower level of Kedusha than it was before. So the Rama has a discussion which is very fascinating. The Rama in Chosha Mishpah talks about two practical cases. And the Rama here, you see from the way he describes it, it seems that there was shul politics already in the days of the Rama. This is nothing new. What are the stories that the Rama gives us? Number one, he says the following. You have designated seats in the shul, and you have Reuven and Shimon are sitting next to each other, and each one of them has their own designated place. V'Reuven rotza lasas mechitza b'neihem. Reuven decides, I don't like the guy next to me. Now, I'm not going to kick him out of his seat, and I'm not going to go find another seat. I paid to have this seat, he paid to have that seat. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to put a mechitza b'neihem. I'm going to put something in between the two of us. Maybe he's a big tzaddik, he doesn't want to talk to him. Maybe, whatever it is, they don't want to talk during davening, he's going to put up a mechitza. Now, obviously, I'm not going to put up the mechitza in the middle of his spot, I'm going to put the mechitza in my area. So I'm designated this spot. I have this amount of room. I'm going to put the mechitzas and make my room smaller. So says the Rama, Shimon wrote to La'akev. Shimon says, I don't want to have a piece of wood in between us. Why? Because when you're not here, I'm able to stretch out. Or even when you are here, sometimes my arms go over. And therefore, he's not happy about the mechitza that's being proposed to be put in between the two seats. So the Rama says, Hadinim Reuven. Reuven is allowed to put up the mechitza because he's putting it up in his property. He's putting it up in his place in shul. And therefore, the other person doesn't have a right to put up any sort of opposition to your erecting a mechitza there. That's case number one. Case number two. V'chein rabim hayoshim al safsalecha bebeis haknesses. Let's say we have one long row. We each paid for a seat, and we have designated seats. V'hayoshim berosh rotze lahosif od makom echad etzel makomo. So now we have a whole row of seats. And now my daughter gets married, and I have a son-in-law. So sit next to me, but there's no more room on the bench. So what am I going to do? So I decide I'm going to put another chair there. I add another chair at the end of the bench. So there, Hayoshev Berosh, the one who's sitting at the edge, wants to add another seat for his son or his son-in-law. And now Hayoshev Etzlo, the person who's second on the bench, Rotza Limchos, he wants to protest, how can you add another seat? I paid this amount of money that I should be the second one in the row. I don't want to be bumped down to be now the third one in the row, that every time I need to get out, I have to go by two people instead of one. For some reason, it's considered to be more chashuv to sit on the aisle instead of in the middle. So he says, I don't want to be sitting three in, I want to be sitting two in. And therefore he protests and he says, you have no right to get in the way and to add another seat. Says the Rama, Hadin imo v'yachal limchos. You have the right to protest, you have the right to say, well, malim ha-kodesh v'lo maridin. I used to have a seat that was closer to the bima, I used to have a seat that was closer to the yaron, whatever it is, and now you're adding another seat, you're getting in the way. Says the Rama, you don't have a right to do that. The same way, the Rama says, the same way that we have a principle that the beam that went in this particular corner of the Mishkan always had to go there, and you don't have a right to move it over, so too over here. You don't have a right to move me and put me in another place. Now, this is a very fascinating story, because there's a story that's told about the Levushei Srad. The Levushei Srad has a sefer on Shulchan Aruch. He was one of the great gedolim that lived in the end of the 1700s into the 1800s. He was actually one of the great talmidim of the Barduchever. So he was a chassidische Rebbe, and he wrote the sefer Arvei Nachal, but he also wrote the sefer, not in Hashkafa, not in Machshava, he wrote the sefer Levushei Srad, which is a halacha sefer. So he had a story that came to him in his community. I don't know exactly where he lived, somewhere in Galicia. So he writes that he had the story that there were two balabatim who were fighting about the following. What happened? They had a bench and a shul. Everybody paid for a particular seat. Now the shul decided, we have so many members, we have to expand the building. So now they expanded the building. Once they expand the building, they decided, well, we may as well extend every row also. We want to add on extra seats to the row. So we're going to keep all the seats the same, but now we're just going to sell the extra seats that we added on to the shul. Makes a lot of sense. This way we don't have to redo everything. So the gabbayim of the shul, the president, the board of the shul decided they were going to charge for the new seats. The old guard from the shul said, we paid for the seats in the old shul that we had. And there's no reason why now you're going to add another seat and now somebody else is going to be closer to the yaron. The reason why I paid so much money for this seat is because I was the first one in the row. I was the closest to the yaron. But now you're putting somebody else in the way. And they came to the Levushei Srad to ask, who has the right of way here? Who should say whether these old balabatim have the right to say, we paid for the seat and therefore you have no right to add an extra seat at the end of the bench? Or maybe the board of the shul is correct that they say, well, now we made an expansion and we're not really doing anything. We're not moving you. You're staying where you were. We're not taking away your seat. We're just adding another seat. Is that considered taking away somebody's seat? Is that considered a downgrade? Or do we say you stayed the same, just the situation around you changed? So listen, such a brilliant answer he gave. He brings a proof from the fact in Parshas Lech Lecha. We're told that Sarai Imenu's name changes from being Sarai to being Sara. So the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that the Yud from Sarai was given to Hoshea ben Nun. When his name changes to Yehoshua, that was the Yud, so to speak, that was taken from Sarai, was given to Yehoshua, and now his name became Yehoshua instead of being Hoshea. So the Rishalmi says that the letter Yud comes to Hashem with a taina and says, I used to be a very important letter, I was part of the name of Sarah. And now you're taking me away, what's going to be? So Hashem says, don't worry, I'm going to appease you because now you're going to be at the front of the word, you're going to be at the front of the word Hoshea. And that's what the Yerushalmi says, the letter Yud was appeased. So the Levush HaYisrael asked the question, why was the letter Yud appeased, but now the letter Hey is going to feel bad? Why? Because the letter Hey used to be the front of the word Hoshea, and now he's bumped off. Now he's going to be the second into the name. So shouldn't he have a tain on the Ribono Shel Olam as well? So the Levush HaYisrael said, you see that when you don't move someone over, when you keep someone in the same place, you just put somebody else in front of them, that's not called a downgrade. That's not called a downgrade at all. And that's the raya that he wanted to bring. That's the proof that he wanted to bring to the story that the Rama raises here in Choshen Mishpat. A fascinating story, interesting psak that he gave based on a strange source. But either way, we have this halacha of Malim HaKodesh Velo Maridim. And based on this, the Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva, what happens if you reconfigure a shul, and now you do construction, and now you're trying to figure out, well, maybe we can have a better place to put the bima. Instead of the bima being over there, now the room is so much bigger, we should put it somewhere else. Chasam Sofer says you have to have a major discussion about that because it could be the place in the shul where the bima was has the schus of having the bima. And now to move it somewhere else is not really fair because that's where it belongs, because that's where it used to be before. So the Berhetev writes in Hilchos Sukkah, the Berhetev writes that the same way we have this principle when it comes to building the Mishkan, that each beam has to be in the proper place, so too, he argues, when you build a sukkah also, you have to mark off exactly where each beam was, exactly where each panel is supposed to be, and the next year you have to put it back in the same place. And the Yaruch Laner and the Bikur Yaakov argue, that's a ridiculous assumption. That has nothing to do with the story by the Mishkan. The reason why by the Mishkan you have to put it in a particular place is because one part of the Mishkan had more Kedusha than the other part of the Mishkan. One part of it was closer to the Kodesh HaKadosh, and one part of it was where the Avodah was done, and the other part was not. But over here by a sukkah, all sides are equal. And that's why we don't assume that this Berhetiv is correct. His assumption that we can apply this principle also to sukkah the same way we have it by Mishkan is not really so simple, and that's why we generally do not apply it. But another application that's given, lehalacha, is the Magen Avraham in Hilchos Tzitzis. The Magen Avraham writes that he heard in the name of the Shalah HaKadosh that the Shalah had a practice to make an atara on a talis made of silk. The Shalah used to make an atara on the talis made of silk in order that a person should know which part of the talis is up and which part of the talis is down. And says the Magen Avraham, makes a lot of sense. This way you know which side is up, which side is down. The same way we find by the Mishkan that you have to put a demarcation on each beam to know exactly where it belongs. So too on the talis you have to know exactly where it belongs. And then he quotes that the Arizal rejected the practice. And the Arizal said, he doesn't see any reason to make an atar. What's the difference if it's on top of your body or on the bottom of the body? Either way, you're wearing the talis on your body. So that's the same as the sukkah. The same way on the sukkah, we don't care where the panel was last year, where it is this year. The whole sukkah has the same kedusha. So too, the whole talis has the same kedusha. It's not the same. It's not comparable at all to the story by the Mishkan where you have to put the beams in a very particular place. So this is the major discussion by whether or not you have to have an atar on a talis, whether there's any reason to. There was major objection, actually, to having an atar on a talis. Many Acharonim say they thought it was the wrong thing to do. Why? Because, let's say you would have a talis like the Reform Talisim that only cover your head and the top of your shoulders. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, a talis like that, that looks like a scarf or something of that nature that doesn't cover your body, is not really considered a good enough talis. It has to be a certain size in order to be considered a real talis. So here, the Shulchan Aruch writes, if you have a talis that's only made the chasos es harosh, if it's only made to cover your head like a scarf, that's not really considered a talis at all. So therefore they argue, if you're going to put an atar on the top of the talis, people might mistakenly think that the main part of the talis, the ikar of the talis, is the head. And really, that's incorrect. The main part of the talis is the part that covers your body. So that's why there are some achronim that say, if you want to put an atar to beautify the talis or to show which side is up or down, you should also have, like the Hasidic Rebbes do, to put the silver in the middle of the talis also, to show that not just the top of the talis is important, but the middle of the talis is also important. But forgetting that issue that they have, the issue basically is, who said that there's any reason to highlight the top of the talis other than the bottom? There's no reason to say that this part is more kaddish and that part is less, and perhaps that's why the Achronim say there might not be any reason to have an atara. So there is a raya from our parsha where they discuss the following issue. The Magen Avraham talks about the story Let's say I bring my tefillin to a sofer and I want him to check it out. So he takes the whole thing apart. Does he have to remember which side of the Ritzua was up near the bias, near the kesher, and does he have to remember which side was down? Now that he's retying everything, does he have to do it specifically the way it was, or can he do it the other way around, and it's not important which way it goes, because a Ritzua on the tefillin is a Ritzua on the tefillin. What's the difference? So the Magen Avraham and others discuss this issue, and they say, well, maybe you could bring a proof from the story by Yaakov Avinu. What happens by Yaakov Avinu? In our parsha, Yaakov Avinu goes to sleep. All the stones are fighting, the Medrash says, and all of a sudden they become into one big stone. And now everybody calms down. So I ask, why did they calm down, says the Magen Avraham? Why should they calm down? Yaakov Avinu is not going to be able to put his head on every single part of the stone. Yaakov Avinu is only going to put his head on a little part of the stone, on a portion of it. So therefore, says the Magen Avraham, you see that from the fact that they weren't arguing anymore, once they became into one, you see, once something is considered all one chetzah, once it's all attached, there's no issue of being on the top, on the bottom. They're all considered to be participating in the given mitzvah that you're dealing with. And therefore, there were those who wanted to argue that when it comes to the tefillin, doesn't matter if the ritzua is going to be on the top, closer to the parashios, or the ritzua is going to be on the bottom. It shouldn't make a difference because either way, we assume once it's all connected, once it's all part of the tefillin, there's no reason why one side of it is considered more chashiv or more kaddish, more sanctified than another portion of it. That's a discussion that some achronim have. And there are others who reject it and say, what do you mean? You're going to bring a proof from the story of Yaakov Avinu just because some miracle happened over there and Yaakov Avinu's stones weren't fighting anymore. Therefore, you're going to bring a proof to the story by tefillin. That's not really a conclusive raya. You'll say over there, you don't bring a proof from Agada, from a story in Chazal that has some sort of allegorical meaning. And you also don't bring a proof from a Maisa Nisim, from a miracle that happened in the times of Yaakov Avinu. Not really such a conclusive evidence. But anyway, this all comes down to the basic principle that we're dealing with here, and that is, Malam HaKodesh V'lo Maridin is a principle, is a concept that the Gemara does discuss. And the question is, how far do we take it? Do we take it as far as the Ramah went, that it applies even to seats in a shul? If you add shul seats when you have an expansion to the building, should it apply there? Do we take it as far as the sukkah panels, like the Be'er Heitiv said? And do we apply it even when you have one chepzah shel mitzvah, when you have one object of a mitzvah and you have different parts of it? Should we assume that all of them are considered on the same level? Or do you say it depends which part of the item you're dealing with? Perhaps the one that's closer to the Kedusha has more sanctification, and the other part is less sanctified than the top part might be. Rabbi Chanan ben Akash, Omer Ratzak.